sorry. Welcome back. I'll start over. The next item on our program is a great presentation on the peat moss forecast and update that's going to be presented by, is being presented by Paul Short, who is president of the Canadian Sphagnum and Peat Moss Association. Paul's been with us last in Dallas. And it's been a couple of years, so this is a great opportunity for us to update. And you'll notice that we had in the recent newsletter, I believe, a press release on what was going on with peat moss forecast. But this is more than this. This is more than that. This is a greater overview of what's going on in the peat industry and some of the things that they're doing on sustainability and future forecasting and having to do with serving their members and the supply chain requests for sustainability information. He's got some great information for you. So he's down from Canada, and we almost speak the same language. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Good morning, all. I'm fighting the cold, so comes across as a bit different. Just put it down to my language difference. Thanks very much for the opportunity. Peat moss and the Moss and Soil Council and substrate issues. I mean, we are, what I think you'll hear today will be some of the main points or similar points that you're hearing in your own industry. I was asked to look at the whole concept of what's happening with the resource. I'm giving an update on the 2015 harvest. Many of you who have read the Moss and Soil Council's latest news release will have already read some of this. I'll talk about some of the challenges we're facing with peatland management in Canada. And research on peatland restoration, I think it will be an update on what's going on in some of our sustainability and industry policy practices that we're getting more and more engaged in. Just a bit of a primer on our resource. Canada has 113 million hectares, with about 256 million acres of peatland. That's approximately one quarter of the world's supply. So there's 400 million hectares worldwide. Russia's more than we are, but we're probably the second largest contiguous land base in the world for peat. Now, peat that I'm talking about, or peatlands that I'm talking about, are two types, bogs and fens, okay? We'll get into the details of all that. We focus mostly on the bogs. So when I talk peatlands, however, it's very critical that you talk about the you understand it's the bogs and fens relationship. Much of our land base is across the whole country, but you'll see because of the coloration, it's in the northern boreal landscape, and that'll come into play in some of the discussions I'm having a little later on. Our peat production sites in Canada, the red dots, as you can see across the, we have about 16,000 hectares actively used for peat moss production. I should have transferred this into to acres, but it's and I haven't. So 16,000 hectares. It's about 0.01% of the entire land base. So we're not really affecting a large amount of the Canadian resource, if you want to look at it that way. Over the entire time frame that we've been involved in Canada, our industry, which is probably about 60 years to 70 years, we've only affected about 27,000 hectares. Or at some point in our activity, it has been drained. And that's about 0.02%. So this is 2014 data. So where's the production coming from? 42% is from New Brunswick, and that's the province right here. 42% of our production comes from that area. Quebec, South Shore and North Shore. This is important a little later on when I talk about the harvest 2014, or the 15 harvest. Quebec produces 29%. Ontario, Manitoba, right now is about 13%, this area here. Alberta is about, I think it says 12%. The rest, Saskatchewan. There'll be a new dot here and a few more new dots here the next time we speak. A few more dots are going to be coming into Manitoba as well. Ontario, perhaps one or two, and maybe some more in New Brunswick as we move forward in the future. Newfoundland and Saskatchewan and Ontario make up the 5% remaining. I wanted to just mention the fact that, as you can see the percentage breakdown, the bogs in eastern Canada are deeper than the bogs in western Canada. That's basically a geological reality. Glaciation didn't affect the ones in the east. So when we see some production numbers, or when we talk about the production numbers, and most of the country say from 42% from New Brunswick, new bogs that are being opened in New Brunswick are going to have a longer lifespan than the ones in western Canada. They're probably intergenerational, some 2 to 3 generations, so you're talking 40 to 50 years. So when you say the supply of peat, eastern Canada, even though it's been in the business longer than western Canada, the bogs are deeper, the lifespans are longer. So you're talking now, if a bog was opened up in eastern Canada, they may have a lifespan of about 40 or maybe 50 years. New bogs in western Canada will probably have a 20 to 25 year, maybe 30 year at the most. So you can see that there's a lot more, as I said, dots coming on there in the next probably 5 to 10 years in terms of supply. This is our harvest. We perhaps have seen some of the words in writing, but there's some of the numbers projected as of August 31st. And the survey of the members, when we conducted it for the status, this includes an estimate of what can be expected to be harvested for the remainder of the season. And that's a percentage of the 2015 expected harvest. So each company is asking, what are you expecting to produce this year? And that's what you put it on. Our folks don't give me the numbers. And even if I told them to ask them to and integrate it into a common number, I don't have the specific production number. So that's why we go by percentage. In general, the harvest season has been adequate. The lack of a strong overall harvest may challenge peat availability. The prairie provinces, if you remember the diagram, Manitoba at 98%, Saskatchewan at 88%, and Alberta at 94%, experienced fairly favorable weather conditions and a strong start to the year. This helped to minimize periodic negative weather-related conditions during the balance of the harvest season, and the harvest numbers are close to achieving expected results. So Western Canada, and this is, we've had, I remember the previous speaker talked about the El Nino effect. When I left Alberta yesterday, the targeted temperature was 18 degrees Celsius. That's still 13 degrees above normal. So we're getting a prolonged and warm fall. The harvest has continued, not as aggressively as in the summertime, but they still are harvesting in Alberta. It's a bit beyond the best before date. Normally, it's usually over by end of about, or middle of October, generally. But it's been extended for the last 3 years now, or 4 years. So El Nino is giving us a bit of a window to be able to gather more. Now that's good and bad in some sense, and I'll get into that in a minute. In Quebec's North Shore, at 52%, and South Shore, 72%, the results are well below expectations, primarily due to a late start and continuous often heavy rain throughout the balance of the season. The Maritime provinces, remember we talked about 42% of the production coming out of this area, is the largest peat producing region in Canada. Yeah, industry has achieved its expected harvest results. So New Brunswick North is about 98%, New Brunswick South is 94%, and PEI, Prince Edward Island, is 88%. They have more favorable weather conditions and longer stretches for harvesting than a normal harvest year. However, currently, due to a relatively low entry inventory level, now what I mean by that is that each year what we project, we ask, or what the companies are trying to do is have a 15% carryover to start up the following year. But this year we entered into a fairly low level of our inventory. And regional harvest shortages, as I said, Quebec is not up to expectation. The supply of the product, particularly from the east, may suffer. Customers may see product from non-regional shipping points, and as a result, higher transportation costs may occur. This would have been a real challenge in terms of the transportation costs, beginning of last year. Reason? We had a lot of product comes by rail, and we couldn't get rail cars. Why? Oil coming south, and grain, and lumber. All priority above feed. So we were doing a lot of transshipping with trucks, and even the trucks were getting hard to get to. That may not be the case right now, the economy the way it is. However, there is going to be some additional cost. As I said, the western production is higher. To move it from the west to the east is going to cost, and there may be an additional cost because of that. I want to move now to a discussion on some Canadian peatlands management issues that I'm facing, and I want to, my pain will be yours. No, I want to just discuss these so that you have some understanding of what's happening. I know that you will also be facing the same things. Some of the biggest issues we're facing is the international conventions, International Convention on Climate Change and Convention on Biological Diversity are the two key drivers that are challenging us as an industry right now. We've been trying to get, if you want a real summary of what that might be to your industry as well as ours, is an excellent document that was put together by the International Peace Society. It's called International Conventions, Agencies, and Agreements and Programs. Implication for peat and, I'd say, mulching soil, and peatland management. The other area that we're having some really good conversation with is the United Nations Food, FAO, Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO. Interestingly enough, they're attacking this whole issue of peat use from the tropical standpoint. They are talking about it in the sense of issues like in Malaysia and the Philippines, and unfortunately we're being all tarred with the same brush. There's no peat from Malaysia getting into North America. It's not happening. What we're facing, however, is some of the challenges because the Malaysian approach to the peatlands, which are the tropical peatlands, are much different. I mean, they have drained these things for rice production, they have drained them for palm oil production, and the consequences of subsidence and fires. I don't know, about 5 years ago, there was a big international conference in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. You couldn't see those big iconic towers. Why? Because of the burning of the peatlands through massive fires that have resulted because of subsidence and lack of water. We're dealing with that in North America. And I think the questions of climate change, and I'll get to that in a second, are going to really come up. Well, I'll get to it right now. We just elected a new government, a Liberal government. They have a very strong platform, policy-wise, to address the questions of climate change. It's climate change after December, when they go to Paris. I don't know what the new administration, the current administration, and the future administration is going to be like in the U.S., but the alliance around the issues of climate change are going to affect us significantly. Carbon sequestration, carbon management are big issues that we're dealing with now on the intergovernmental basis. I'll now segue into the discussion on some national initiatives. National Wetlands Forum, there's a conversation going on in Canada. Wetlands, 85 to 87, depending on who you talk to, of the concept of wetlands are peatlands. Okay, so when you talk about national wetland conversation in Canada, by and large, you're talking about peatlands. That's going on right now. That's drawing a lot of folks, a lot of political energy, a lot of discussions around First Nations issues. I know you don't have that in the U.S., but the First Nations issues, to the extent that we have in Canada, is becoming much more engaged, and we have to be involved with it. There's a group called Boreal Leadership Council. Now, the Boreal landscape is much of what you saw that slide of Canada at the beginning is in what they call the Boreal. The Boreal land is north of pretty much all the prairies and the central part of Canada. And that leadership is trying to look at protecting 50% of the land base from future development. And so we're monitoring the activities of this kind of, and they are an independent organization, non-governmental, that is trying to form a framework around how to deal with these questions to influence federal and provincial governments. We also have issues around the Species at Risk Act, SARA. SARA is a federal government agenda that is impacted on the provinces who have the resource responsibility. Division of accountability in Canada is the federal government makes some of these policy decisions, air, water, and land, and the provinces have a responsibility for the resource delivery. One of the key issues that we're facing, especially in Western Canada, is the caribou. The caribou, the populations of caribou. Just very quickly, the Species of Risk Act says that you have to have 65% of intact habitat. In some provinces in Western Canada, particularly Alberta, that's impossible. Between the oil and gas activity, the forestry activity, certainly not because of the peat activity, these do not have 65% intactness of their habitat. So we're really challenged by some of this conversation. Just wanted to give you a flavor of some of the national agenda issues that we're going to be dealing with. On a provincial basis, these are some of the activities that are now emerging and have been in place for the last 2 to 3 years. The New Brunswick is doing a wetlands policies review. Again, remember, 85 to 87% are peatlands, and then even more in New Brunswick. Quebec is doing a Mines and Minerals Act review and a wetlands compensation package. That's a very interesting issue in terms of mitigation. Ontario just announced in the last 2 months a process towards establishing a wetland policy. Manitoba, Peatlands Stewardship Act. This is a seminal document. It was the first time in Canada that we've created an actual piece of legislation which directly addresses the issue of peatlands and peat use. We were involved in the activities, we were engaged with them, and we were quite satisfied with the outcome. There's an emerging group called the Peat Practices Committee. We will be a part of that. The Peat Practices Committee will be establishing how we actually implement this new act. In Alberta, we have an implementation of a wetland policy, and there's a framework for peat management. We're having a conversation with the government, and we've been doing it for the last 3 years, as to how they're going to actually manage peat. You might mention this at this time. Peat resources, as much as you saw in that diagram, it's like the Rodney Dangerfield of resources. It gets very little respect. It doesn't have a lot of legislation. It's considered as a part of the Water or Wetlands Act, Public Lands Act. There's about 60-some-odd pieces of legislation across Canada. But the reality of it is that nothing addresses the actual resource itself from a resource standpoint. We're trying to move the bar in that conversation. Manitoba, as I just said earlier, is probably the seminal document, the Peatlands and Stewardship Act, and it's one of the first. Touch on some of the research in peatland restoration. We've been at it for 23 years. The PERG is the Peat Ecological Research Group. These are the institutions, University of Laval, McGill, University of Waterloo. Those are basically Eastern Calgary, Western Canada. We have a new one, University of Brandon in Manitoba as well. And this is all being led by Dr. Lynn Rushworth. There are two basic programs, an NSERC chair and an NSERC collaborative research agreement. And the industrial investment is about $7 million from 96 to 2018. And there are 14 companies providing that. The goal of peatland restoration in Canada is to restore the functions of peatlands, especially the most unique ones, which are biodiversity, carbon cycling, or greenhouse gas emissions. We focus on carbon, but methane is equally as challenging. In fact, methane is, if you depend on who you talk to, 10 to 15 times more potent from a greenhouse gas standpoint than carbon or CO2 emissions. And methane on the natural landscape for a peatland is there. It's part of the agenda. And the third function is hydrology. So what we're trying to do is replace the peat accumulating capabilities post-harvest. And I use that word harvest. We are pushing back against the agenda that had us as mining. We are not a mine. This is not a biological. This is a biological resource, not a mineral. We use biological processes to replace the actual biological material. And this is one that's been pioneered by that PERG group, and has now become a world leader in how to restore peatlands. It's called the moss layer transfer technique, and some of you have already seen this. But basically, it looks at planting, surface preparation, post-harvest site, plant collection from a donor site. Now that usually is the next area that you're going to be going into for the harvest of your bud. Plant spreading. This is the live spores and propagules are spread by a manure spreader. Straw spreading, very critical in terms of putting a a small microclimate to protect the actual new germination that's coming through. Fertilization is optional depending on what your material, your program is, and block ditching, and then monitoring. The unrestored site on the left, a restored site in the middle, and a natural landscape on the right-hand side. So we're critically evaluating the biodiversity, hydrology, and carbon cycling. And the reason for that is, goes back to the previous slide, which I said, what are the key drivers on the international side? Climate change and conventional biological diversity. We have to align our research so that we're able to give the answers to these international challenges and to give the evidence to the provincial authorities as to the best way and best practices for regulating our managed river resource. This is the current knowledge. Typical bog plan, this is after about a 10-year time frame. They've gone back after all the research and said, okay, what do we know? So current state, this is only, let's say current state, 2 years ago. Okay, so typical bog plan cover established within a few years following restoration is dominated by sphagnum mosses. 2 to 3 years, you've got sphagnum moss complex coming back on the post-harvest site. Restoration is successful in returning the organic matter accumulation to values that are comparable to those of natural systems. So we're addressing the biodiversity challenge. The hydrology. The water table rises quickly after ditch blocking and hydrological conditions are improved. However, the water table fluctuates more than in natural peatlands. Research is suggesting, and we're continuing to do the research on this, that it will take between 15 to 20 years to accumulate a thick enough moss layer that will again regulate the water. So we're addressing the hydrology. This is some of the most interesting. The last one is research suggests that annual carbon balance can be returned to near natural conditions within 10 to 15 years following restoration. That's important in the sense that it addresses that carbon sequestration issue. We're being labeled as being emitters of carbon. We are. This is a biological material. You have the same agenda. Mulch and soil, mulch part of it is a biological product. It will emit and give off gases. It will become a challenge, I suspect, under whatever new administration comes into the U.S., because if they sign anything that is anywhere near what we are hearing in the Canadian agenda in December, it will be a part of every one of your agenda around the table. Your companies will be asked, what is your footprint? What is your greenhouse gas emission issues? And we'll address some of the challenges going on that in a minute. So this is a picture of a restored bog in eastern Canada. It's called Bois de Belle Bog. It's really the pilot, the threshold type bog research. We're having challenges in western Canada because they say that you can't replicate that. Interestingly enough, just within the last 6 months, we found a bog that had been restored 21 years ago that looks pretty darn close to this in western Canada. So there's a bit of a aha moment here, and we're now trying to make sure that we have the science-based evidence to be able to say to the government of Alberta, this is what you can do, this is what you expect. There are no regulations that are fixed and telling us exactly what we have to do. Why? Because it goes back to that question, it gets more respect. This is a resource that they haven't really understood the dynamics of that. So what are we doing with this? Restoration and policy and practices, we're looking at responsible peatland management. We use the term responsible, not sustainable, because we know that we cannot replace the entire biological material, the peat, that was in that bog prior to harvesting within any living human being's lifetime. These bogs, the bog material is in eastern Canada, 8 to 10,000 years of accumulation. Western Canada is probably 6,000 years of accumulation. Interestingly enough, the ecosystem that's living, they call it the aquitaine, which is the living ecosystem that produces the peat, the bog material, is probably in Western Canada only because of fire situations, only 240 years old. That's the cycle of renewal that occurs in the bog material in Western Canada. Eastern Canada, it's a little longer. It's probably around 300 to 400 years before that bog material is actually completely replaced. Much different dynamics. So what we're saying, and you'll see some of this, so we're looking at research, science-based adaptive management, resource management, and this is what we're trying to produce. The documentation that gives evidence as based on science, what it is that they're actually conducting. We have established a the Preservation Reclamation Policy, a CSBMA position paper. We've adopted the International Feed Society Strategy for Responsible Feedlot Management. This is an excellent document that if, you know, both of them, if you wish to get copies, are on our website. The best practices activities in 2003 was the Feedlot Restoration Guide on the left. And now we've got some more current information in 2013 on feedlot restoration. These are operations manuals. The chart in the middle, this is not without cost. To restore these per hectare is $3,485, roughly. That's what it costs. I keep coming back to what we're doing in terms of activities with the government, increasing activities with international levels. These are the costs to restore. This all is a cost that the companies are in some way passing on in their product. I want you to know about these things so that when you start hearing issues, you say, why does this always seem to be moving, a moving agenda for the cost? These are pretty constant costs, and some of them are pretty near. A lot of you know about the certification challenges. We already have a Verifora certification, a responsible management peatland certification. It's a standard plus a sector-specific annex for Verifora. It's a world standard eco-certification, that is the SCS at Verifora. I might also mention that there's a new European peatland certification scheme that has been put together, so there's only two in the world. This Verifora certification, it favors restoration of carbon, encourages continued improvements and stimulates innovation, promotes social responsibility, provides natural third-party process and rigorous annual on-site inspections. This is what we actually are measured on an annual basis. What we call the responsible management is our harvest plans are reviewed, air quality management is reviewed, rehabilitation plans, you can read them all there. The resource conservation and energy efficiency of the companies, assessment of greenhouse gases, reduction of the reduction goals, integrated waste management, fair labor practices, community benefits, product quality, and product traceability. Fair labor practices and community benefits. They're becoming as much a part of the agenda as understanding your environmental footprint. What are we doing in the social agenda? So when we look at sustainability, we look at environmental, social, and economic. And we're trying to make sure that people have that information to go forward within the companies as well as within the industry. We've also conducted an environmental life cycle of our product. This is a document that's on our line again, and you can get a copy if you wish. It's an approach to provide a list of impacts. What is the agenda of these life cycle hotspots? Well, I can tell you it's carbon emissions, a lot of it from the unrestored bog, if you don't do anything with it. And it was measured on a scale of one cubic meter of uncompressed peat. And we looked at the production, conditioning, distribution, and in-situ decomposition. What was not looked at was use. And this is an area where I'd really like to be able to form some collaboration with folks such as yourselves to find out what the use issues are regarding the life cycle. And why do I think that's important? Because the slide demonstrated, the presentation before demonstrated some of the values of actually using a product which would increase the actual sequestration of carbon. The greenhouse gas emissions and the greenhouses of North America are a huge industry. And I don't need to tell you that. But I can't, in all the times I've talked with a lot of the greenhouse operators, they cannot tell me what their climate change footprint is, what their emission issues are, what their sequestration. I had a rose grower in California come up to me one time and give me supreme hell over why do you champion peat, use of peat? I asked him, I said, do you know how many do you grow? He gave me a number and I can't remember. I said, do you know what your sequestration of carbon is with each of those plants? He had no idea. I said, what is your footprint? I gave a rough estimate. I said, every one of those things. It was an immense number of carbon that was being sequestered by his production. And some of that, as you saw, is going into the plants and the roots and as part of the contribution of the soil. But he did not know. And I suspect that a lot of the producers that we, the people that we sell our product to, don't know either. We would like to know, because I think this is as much an important part of what is it doing when it is in the use stage. Photosynthetic processes, locking up a carbon. We've taken the life cycle, our social agenda as well. This is a social life cycle evaluation we did for our product. And we put this together into a document, and the copies of that are at the front of the desk. It's our 2014 Industry Social Responsibility Report. We used an international standard of SAPA guidelines from the FAO. It was a reference tool, and we've adopted it as part of a pilot. We were one of 23 around the world. So this is an industry sustainability report, not a corporate sustainability report. And we're looking at it from a provincial association level and also corporate members. These are the dimensions of the study: the governance, environmental stewardship, economic performance, workers and harmonious cohabitation. Again, economic, social, and environmental are three metrics that are being measured here. So we're telling the world what it is that we do in each of those four boxes according to those various breakdowns based on the environmental life cycle evaluation or social life cycle certification and science. So this was a building process. This did not happen overnight. It took us probably 5 years to get to this stage. These are the commitments and actions that we're taking as a result of this, so it's now beginning to drive our business practices. We're going to continue collaboration on an ongoing basis with organizations to assess and manage greenhouse gas emissions. Why? Because we're going to be measured against it. Support members to adopt greenhouse gas emissions calculations tools and achieve greenhouse gas reduction targets. We're going to continue to support VeriFlor certification process. We have about 65% of our members now are certified, or production coming out of Canada is certified. We want to move it to 75 in the next reporting period, which is 3 years. Excuse me. Ensure that restoration is widely conducted and the best practices adopted by members. Our high bar is that we will restore a bog once we finish harvesting. We know that there are other practices which will be rehabilitating or reclaiming. But that's our bar. Now, if somebody else comes out and says, I want to return to something else, that's the decision of the process for final use. Compile more detailed statistics on the current areas of peat production and post-harvest peatlands. We've got a bit of that in a minute. So this is the current state of peatland in Canada. And as you can see, out of that 16,000 hectares, 59% of them are under production. We've restored, using that mulch, layer transfer technique, about 3%. We're re-wetting about 1%. That's basically blocking the ditches and letting the water come back out. It's called pollutification, which is the main practice in Europe. Tree plantations are about 3%. No action, but it's been well regenerated naturally. That's about 14%. No actions and non-regenerated. That's where we're targeting to come back up. There's about 20%, and we need to make sure that we bring those back to our restored land base. And the others are 0%. So in conclusion, for the coming years, priorities are continued support for research and development of the science-based best management practice. Ensure that restoration of post-harvest sites are conducted and successful. Support the VeriFlor certification process with the membership. And update our various assessments on the environmental life cycle and social life cycle. So I hope I've given you a picture of what is the pressing issues that we face in Canada. One of the things I did not put in here in my slides was, well, what's the value of the end use, where your production is going, and how does it support what's happening? And this is an area of collaboration I'd like to talk to the Mulch and Soil Council about as well. We have evidence right now based on 2007 information from the USGA, DA, that 43 billion dollars of horticultural industry in the U.S. There's one category in there that it breaks it down into a number of other categories. But one of them that really caught my eye was greenhouse vegetable production. And I know a large percentage of our production goes into those areas. That's 3 billion. year. That's B with a billion. That's a lot of money. And that's only, that's just from the USDA statistics report. What we don't know is what is the breakup or breakdown in terms of the actual utilization of peat, bark, compost in making those production numbers. And what's the future? The evidence that we're getting right now, and this is again a part of what I could have put it in, but I'll just add it, is that we're talking to a professor at the University of Laval. His comments were that by 2050 there will be a 70% increase in the use of non-soilless growing media. And the production of superfruits in particular in California is leading this on a world basis. He just came back, this professor I was speaking to last week, just came back from meetings in Indiana with the International Horticultural Sciences people. And they're projecting this kind of increase that is going to change those dynamics. Instead of 3 billion for vegetable production, it'll be a much larger number. What that number is, I don't know. I would like to be able to find some statistical information and evidence that we can give, not only that I can take to give my producers, but also when I talk to the governments of Canada and the provinces of Alberta and the provinces of Canada, as well as on the international scene, that if you're going to hammer us for things like carbon emissions and greenhouse gas issues, let's balance the equation with a conversation around what you're feeding the world. Because these are the kinds of dynamics that we're dealing with. And I think it's also on the table of the folks around this meeting to ask the same questions going forward. Thanks very much. I'll answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, Paul. Any questions? Bill?
Paul, when you're harvesting your bogs, I know they go to different depths, but about how far down do you go before you close it and you start the restoration process?
Well, by the sand, we leave about a meter of peat at the bottom. Basically, that's getting into the classification of the quality of peat that is not the best for horticultural use. We are a horticultural focused owner, so I know in Europe a lot of them go deeper than that because they use it for fuel production, for energy. But it's getting into a classification and post scale that is not it's not the best for horticultural use. So also the practices by the moss transfer technique is suggested that if you leave about a meter of peat in the bottom, it helps the propagation of the and reestablishing the peat line. So and that changes based on the depth of the bog, the conformation of the underlying land base. But that's our general practice.
Anybody else?
It's lunchtime.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks once again.